This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Marianne Zalesnik filling in for Lucy May. We're talking about electric vehicles today. What will President Biden's EV tariffs on China mean for production? How hard is it to find a place to charge a vehicle? Ohio's adding some fast charging stations. And myths about EVs, like they cause more air pollution, they'll collapse the power grid, they're not safe, fact or fiction? We'll answer those questions, too. Joining me today for the program, our staff writer at Wired Magazine, Ariane Marshall, director and senior fellow at the Center for Automotive Research at Ohio State University, Giorgio Rizzoni, and Electrification Coalition director of technical services, Matt Stevens-Rich. Hello, Ariane.
Hello there.
And hello, Giorgio.
Good afternoon.
And hello, Matt.
Hey, good to be here.
Well, we'd like to hear from you, too. If you have a question or a comment, you can call us 513-419-7100 or email talk at wvxu.org. I thought we'd start out talking about the Biden tariff move, the increase on tariffs on EVs in China. And Ariane, perhaps you can start there. Why do you think the president did that?
Yeah, this is a part of this kind of longstanding policy that the Biden administration has been trying to implement. And the big kind of question is whether the U.S. can really become energy dependent in a moment when, climate change is such a huge problem, only continue to become a huge problem. So can we kind of separate from the gas that has powered, so many of our cars, but also so much of our energy system for so long? So this move that happened last week, which was expected in some ways, but also kind of really shocking in others, was that the Biden administration implemented a 100% tariff on Chinese electric vehicles being imported into the U.S., and that's up from the previous level of 25%. That's a really high level of tariffs. And the reason they're doing that in China specifically is because China, because it's been working for so long on making electric vehicles, really focusing on engineering vehicles and bringing down the prices on them, has created these really good, low-cost electric vehicles. And the administration is worried that if those vehicles were allowed to come into the U.S., they would really threaten the domestic auto industry, right, in the country.
Giorgio, do you want to add anything?
Oh, I think that everything Ariane said matches my understanding of things. And there are complexities in these tariffs, of course. I am not completely sure, and maybe Ariane can clarify this, what happens to all the other imports we have from China, such as battery cells or raw materials that are related to the EV production system. What do you think, Ariane?
Yeah, so there was action on that last week as well. And tariffs are going up on those materials as well. I actually think this is probably the big, most interesting part of this story, which is that the U.S. is not only behind in building electric vehicles, it's really behind in creating a supply chain that goes along with those electric vehicles. Yeah. The difference between electric vehicles and gas-powered cars is, of course, the big old battery inside those vehicles. And batteries have particular components in them that we don't really make here. One of my favorite examples is graphite. Graphite is something that's all over the world. It's not hard to find graphite, but the U.S. doesn't have that many places that are both mining graphite, but then also refining and processing that graphite. And in an effort to really prop up a domestic industry here and among our trade allies, something the Biden administration did last week was they increased tariffs on lithium ion batteries from China. That used to be at 7.5%. Now it's at 25%. And it also increased tariffs on those critical minerals that go into the batteries. So those used to have no tariffs at all. And now some of them have 25% tariffs. So those have really gone up as well.
Yeah. Let me add a couple of elements to this. So one of the other behind the curtain aspects of producing batteries is that lithium is mined at some point of origin. And today, for example, In the highlands of the Andes mountain chain in South America, there are vast quantities of lithium available in these huge salt flats. But the lithium that is mined as ore or in on semi-liquid form needs to go through a process called beneficiation, which is essentially the refining of this lithium ore or lithium material to arrive at a battery-grade lithium powder that can then be used by the battery manufacturers. And because of the scale, complexity, and environmental impact of this lithium beneficiation, there isn't as much capacity for doing this kind of work in the US. It takes a long time to get all the approvals to have this kind of operation. So today, a lot of the lithium that is mined in various parts of the world is shipped to China for beneficiation, and then the resulting battery-grade lithium is shipped to the country of production. So some of these things are a little bit hidden behind the curtain because a battery manufacturing plant here in the US today is using lithium that, while may not have been mined in China, it may well have been refined there. So that's an additional element that I think is part of the picture. And again, Ariane, it's not clear to me how that would fit into the tariff scheme. The battery, the finally produced battery, I understand.
So the China does create or manufacture a lot of these batteries, even if the U.S. started creating and building more of these EVs, all those parts would have to, as you talk about, either have to come from other places or they'd have to start, you know, creating a new supply chain in the U.S. How difficult would that be to do?
Well, China, South Korea, and Japan are the three most important dominant battery producers. In the US, we've seen in recent years the announcement of the planning and production of battery manufacturing plants. Here in Ohio, we have two instances. The Ultium plant that GM has created in the northeastern part of the state in collaboration with GM and LG. And more recently, Honda and LG announced a joint venture nearby, I would say just 40 minutes south of Columbus. So these battery plants, of course, need a supply chain. And some will manufacture cells, in which case that means that they need to have a complete supply chain for all of the materials that are required for the cells, which goes back to the point Ariane was making about the tariffs on import of materials.
Ariane, do you think that this is more of a political move for the president in terms of the upcoming election as opposed to an environment, or is this better for the economy than it is for the environment?
Yeah, it's hard. The administration is really walking a fine line here. I'd say the kind of initial announcement here feels pretty political to me. It feels really aimed at the auto industry and, of course, auto workers and maybe even workers in general who really do not want to see their jobs go overseas any more than they already have, and in fact would love to see more jobs in the U.S. And this is ultimately, you know, really an onshoring policy, trying to get manufacturing back to the United States and that kind of work back to the U.S. At the same time, the administration is really trying to emphasize, you know, actions that are going to combat climate change, are going to take emissions out of the system. And it's difficult because and I had a professor from Case Western Reserve University explain this to me last week really well, which is she said they're really trying to walk a fine line here. In the short term, those two goals, the kind of clean good jobs goal and the climate change goal, kind of seem to conflict. In the longer term, they make a lot of sense together. Wouldn't it be wonderful if the U.S. had a really robust clean manufacturing industry? So that's the future the administration is trying to get to. I think there are people who are not sure that those can go together all the time. But it'll be interesting to see if they can kind of thread the needle here.
Georgia, do you have anything you want to add?
I think I agree with all of those comments. I think that the intent at a higher level is a laudable intent. As always, the devil is in the details. But let me say just two quick words. I'm an engineer, and my job is to educate engineers. And so many of the students who come through my classes or do graduate thesis with me end up working in the automotive industry. And so the goal is to try to help this industry change its direction to be innovative and creative. I'll give you a couple of examples. One is, can we develop new battery chemistries that are less dependent on some of these difficult to obtain materials that are not available on US soil, such as nickel, cobalt? They are largely imported, sometimes imported from regions of the world that are geopolitically difficult to manage, e.g., Russia exports 60% of the nickel that is used worldwide. The second comment, also related to rare earth materials, is that in addition to finding ways to design batteries that use more commonplace materials, not so difficult to obtain and so expensive, is on the electric machines. I think it's widely understood that today's electric drives that provide the motive power for cars use permanent magnet electric machines. And these permanent magnets contain rare earth elements that are very difficult to, they're very rare. They call them rare earth magnets for a reason. And so the idea is, could we imagine designs of novel electric machines that can achieve similar performance and efficiency without using these rare earth magnets? And I'm currently right now at the ARPA-E summit. ARPA-E is an agency of the US Department of Energy, and I am surrounded by people who are working on these things. So I think that the goal of progressively transforming our economy and manufacturing processes so that clean energy jobs can be had in the United States, employing people who design and manufacture this new technology, is a great goal, and we need to keep at it.
All right. Well, we are going to continue our discussion about electric vehicles in just a moment, talking about charging stations in Southern Ohio. Where are they? And where are more being built? Stay with us. This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Marianne Zalesnik filling in for Lucy May. Later in the program, we'll talk about the myths you may have heard about electric vehicles. But first, let's talk about getting them charged. More charging stations are coming to Ohio, specifically Southern Ohio. Joining me to talk about the plan are staff writer at Wired Magazine, Ariane Marshall, director and senior fellow at the Center for Automotive Research at Ohio State University, Giorgio Rizzoni, and Electrification Coalition director of technical services, Matt Stevens-Rich. We'd like to hear from you, too. You can call 513-419-7100 or email talk@wvxu.org. Matt, we're going to start with you this time. What is the status of charging stations in our area?
Yeah, it's definitely an exciting time. As you take a look across the state, we have a pretty good coverage across a lot of our metropolitan regions. So think about the Tri-C areas between Cincinnati, Columbus, and Cleveland. To your point, a lot of the new federal funding investment, which is also matched by a lot of private investment, is really focusing twofold. One, along interstates and main state routes. So think I-71, 70, 75, where there's going to be really popular gas station style stops. There's also then a lot of focus and push on community focused charging. So that's going to be a slower form of charging that we typically call level two, which is a great fit for point destinations like museums, restaurants, or even multi-unit dwellings where tenants live. Overall, just to give a sense of size and scale, we're at about 4,000 EV charging ports across the entirety of the state. So we're looking at a significant upswing with a lot of investment of current federal funding allocated to the state. There's $140 million being directed to DC fast charging along those high-speed or along those interstates and state routes. And then we've actually been able to receive additional award for those community chargers, $30 million right now, about give or take.
Let's talk a little bit about the different types of chargers. You were talking about level two, and you have the kind you can just plug your car into at home, and then you have these fast charging stations. Tell me how they are differentiated and what's the difference between fast and slow, time-wise.
Yeah, great question. So there's three levels of charging. The first level, level one, this is quite literally a three-prong outlet, so 110 volts. It's a very slow form of charge, really to be used in the form of emergency or if you really need to be topping up in a very inconspicuous location. Level two charging, this is 240 volts, which is equivalent to your dryer or electrical home cooking or home heating. So very equivalent to that level of charge. This speed of charging, it gets you about 25 to 30 miles of range per hour. So like I mentioned, great fit for if you're stopping off for a couple hours and needing a top up, can definitely get you back your full range if plugged in overnight. And then fast charging, so we call it colloquially DC fast charging. So this is where we're working on a direct current circuit, which lets us pack more electrons far more quickly. So we're able to achieve speeds over 150 to 200 kilowatts per hour. That's a lot of charge. So to give you a sense of charging speed, you're able to get back up to 80% of your battery in about 15 to 20 minutes. And that charging speed is increasing over time as battery technology and charging technology gets better. So definitely exciting, especially just for not just the round town commuter, but someone who really is doing a cross trek across the country, skipping multiple states and being able to charge up on their way.
Giorgio, how is this charging changed? Is it getting better? I mean, people keep hoping it's gonna get better. Is it getting faster?
I think there have been so many improvements. With a little bit of history, you know, the level three charging that Matt described found its first wider spread implementation through the Tesla Supercharger network, which has now opened up to other automakers, so it's widely available. But today there is talk about offering charging at power levels that are as much as three, four times larger than what the Tesla Supercharger can do. These things will come. There are some challenges, or there are two conditions need to occur to do fast charging. And I have no quibbles over the level two charging that you would do at home that can be cost effective. If people can park at home and charge overnight, you can't beat that. But moving to the fast charging that you might need, as Matt said, over a longer trip, there are two constraints. One is the electric power grid at the location where this fast charger is located capable at that particular time in the day of providing the required power? And that depends on the time of year, time of day, region of the United States. And so there is the possibility that you might want very fast charging, but it might not be available. Then there are issues that have to do with the technicalities of getting these larger electrical currents into the vehicle. Flowing current through the cable that charges the vehicle generates heat. If the cable becomes too hot, there will be systems that will prevent it from accepting higher currents. Similarly, inside the car, there is a battery pack with a battery management system. And if by charging this battery at a very fast rate, we overheat it, there are protection mechanisms for that. So one of the things that people have found is that on extremely cold days or on extremely hot days, some of these fast charging capabilities may in fact not be available. A lot of work is being done to improve and advance this technology so that as we move forward, the process of recharging your electric vehicle on the road, as you're taking a road trip, is going to become less and less of a concern and more of a certainty.
Ariane, from the national level, you know, we talk about needing more chargers and more being installed in Ohio. What is it like if you do take a cross-country trip? What's the availability across the country?
Yeah, it really depends, unfortunately, on where you are. There are some regions that have really been working on providing electric vehicle chargers for folks who live in the region for a long time. I think of, for example, California, which is really out ahead in terms of the number of people who are driving electric vehicles right now. Some cities have more EV chargers. And right now, there's a really big effort going on with funding from the federal government to build a nationwide network along highway systems so that about every 50 miles or so, folks taking road trips will be able to charge in the same way that they know they'll be able to get gas right now if they're on a road trip. But it's kind of a difficult time. I do think it's getting better, but the way electric vehicle charging started in the U.S., the folks there were really kind of building the plane as it was flying, trying to develop the technology as they were putting it in the ground. So as a result, I hear a lot of complaints from drivers who are using those public fast chargers that they go down often. Sometimes they show up and there's an error message or they're not able to pay and then therefore not able to get their charge. I've heard an anecdote from a driver that they showed up to a fast charger and there was a bee's nest on the charger. And so they weren't able to charge. These are the kind of things that happen when you're putting new infrastructure in across the country. I think now, both the companies that are building these fast chargers and the governments that are helping to fund them are getting much more sophisticated about what these systems need to, both work and kind of stand the test of time out in the rain, out in the wind. So it's definitely a work of progress. I do think it's moving in the right direction.
You talked about I'm sorry. Go right ahead, Matt.
Oh, no, just Ariane, you made a great point there. There is a usability aspect to this. That's also a really big focus of a lot of federal funding going out the door and focusing on these projects. It sounds simple, right? Like being sure we have canopies or proper lighting when charging at night, but these are the things that do matter. And also really make sure that we're creating proper staples that can really be used by everyday travelers. If helpful to this, and there are some of these elements that are incorporated as a requirement to the federal funds going out. So things, for instance, on ensuring maximum uptime requirements, to Ariane's point of being sure that the chargers are ready to go when you plug in. It is exciting, actually, to that end, to what is called the NEVI program, which is funding a lot of these DC fast chargers. Ohio was the first to open a DC fast charging station with those funds in the country. And what was really exciting about it is you pull up to it, it's at a pilot Flying J station along I-70. So when you pull up to it, there's the regular gas and diesel pumps, and then there's the EV charging station also right next door. So it's very exciting when you come up to these things, and it's very commonplace, fits right in nicely. But there's a lot of excitement and building as more of these get out, and to the collective point of being sure they're easy to use and navigate as well.
Let's talk a little bit about cost. I think people generally know what it costs to fill up their car. And depending on the size of your car and the type of gas you get, I'm going to say a tank is anywhere from $40 to $50 to fill up your tank. What does it cost to charge up to from nearly empty to full charge in a electric vehicle if you use a charging station?
Yeah, happy to chime in first. And Georgie, I'll throw it to you for further thought.
Sure.
Electricity is cheaper than gasoline. It's about $1.19 a gasoline gallon equivalent. So that is to say, for the amount of energy in 1 gallon of gasoline, the equivalency in price of electricity is about $1.19. So the good news is it is cheaper overall and can usually translate to anywhere from $1,000 to $2,000 in cost savings on national average, depending on how many miles you're driving and what the gasoline equivalent would be. For public charging, so a lot of the public chargers that we're describing, there is a price premium associated with that, which is billed at a per kilowatt basis. On the whole, though, for majority of EV drivers, majority of charging happens back at the home. So it is essentially a part of your regular monthly electric bill. So sometimes it's helpful to think of it as the public charging, definitely on needed and on the go when needed for use. But then majority of the charging, when it can happen at home, that leads to the most cost savings.
We did get a question from Rob who said, what are the options for charging at home if you don't have a driveway and park on the street? If I want to install a charging station, can it be shared with other neighbors? I've emailed the city to ask. It's also basically a question about what your options are if you live in an apartment or somewhere that doesn't have a garage that you can plug into. What are your options?
Yeah, happy to chime in. And it's a great flag. A lot of new focus is going to how do we meet the charging need for those without dedicated off-street parking or even just an ability to put a charging in at home. The good news, especially the city, has really focused on creating very central public chargers to the pricing point too, also making sure that they're within a fair market value so that it's able to really be commensurate to the energy that's being used. It is growing, is the good news on that front. Another piece to this too, and it's a little bit more of a longer term perspective, but also a lot of cities are looking at different levels of EV readiness. So essentially how that can be included in requirements for new buildings as they go in to be sure that there's charging ready from day one versus needing to go back in and retrofit it.
But this person couldn't put a charger on the street that was in front of his house because he parks on the street. I mean, that would not really be legal. Is that correct? Do you know?
I do know the city does actually have some guidance for those that to the level one charging, basically being able to still charge your vehicle safely and also make sure you're not creating accidental tripping hazard. It's definitely an option for the more inner city dweller, as it were. But so too, there can definitely be some of those options for putting in a level two charger and being able to share it with neighbors. I actually have done that at my own personal home, where as other neighbors, as they buy EVs, they needed a place to charge. Always happy to share the charge port and coordinate on that.
Our phone number is 513-419-7100. If you have a question, Christopher, what's your question? Christopher, what's your question?
Can you hear me?
Yes.
Yes, can you hear me?
I can.
I had the same question that just was brought up about parking on the street and what the plan is there. I talked to the city, and as was mentioned, there's a way to cover the cords with some sort of ramp surface that doesn't create an obstacle. But I also look at my street, and the utility has a pole every 100 feet. Every few of those poles has a transformer on it, and I wonder if there's any talk of the utilities providing their own charger on their pole to be used by the public in the inner city.
Do any of you know the answer to that?
I don't know a specific answer, but I can tell you that right now, among the programs that the U.S. Department of Energy is offering funding opportunities for, there are programs that are specifically aimed at developing creative ideas to provide charging specifically to people who don't live in single homes and don't have the convenience of the driveway and the garage. And so the suggestion that was just made by Chris, if I remember the name correctly, of a utility company looking to create a partnership with the federal government to receive some support to deploy and demonstrate some of these solutions is certainly a viable topic. There is a lot of activity going on right now in this space, and it has been recognized that this is one of the obstacles that needs to be overcome.
All righty. Well, thank you so much for your call, Christopher. Good luck. I hope we hear more about this as time goes on and the city can answer some questions for you as well. Thank you. This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. We're talking about charging an electric vehicle, where to do it, and how easy or hard is it in Ohio to do that? We talked a little bit about the cost. I had a person come up to me at the station today and say, what about replaceable batteries? Are we ever going to get to a point where you can just pull in and just like you do with your grill, you give them your old container for the gas for your grill and you get a new one? Can you just switch out a battery as you go? Is that a possibility anywhere along the way?
Sure. That is, first of all, not a new idea. A gentleman by the name of Shai Agassi, some 10, 12, 15 years ago, conceived of this initiative. His company was called Better Place. And if you have a geographically well-defined area and vehicles that all use the same battery packs, that is something that in principle could work. There are some obstacles to it. One is that we really haven't standardized lithium batteries. You go from one vehicle to the next, and the packs are geometrically different, the voltage is different, the physical location is different. So there are really many challenges that to be overcome. A second important problem is that a battery pack is a very high voltage, high energy object. So in the design of the vehicle, the engineers would have to make provisions to be able to, first of all, easily and inexpensively remove the battery pack. For example, put the vehicle on a hydraulic lift, and then there is a system that allows you to drop the pack and load the new one. But you're moving an object that contains a huge amount of energy and very high voltage. So how to do this safely is another important concern. There is a third point that needs to be considered. The battery today is the most expensive part of the battery electric vehicle. How many more batteries would you need to be able to provide a swapping service? Meaning that if I have 1,000 vehicles on the road, there are 1,000 batteries, and that's the cost of the batteries. But who's going to pay for the extra, let me say, 200 batteries that you would need to have the ability to swap on demand and then recharge? So there are still many questions that are being raised here. The thought is a viable one going forward, something that surely will be considered, maybe for special applications, okay? Commercial vehicles, for example. I do know that in China, there are a couple of auto companies that have launched swapping stations in major Chinese cities, and they are actually doing this.
All right. Well, thank you so much for that. I have one more question before we take our next break, and it's related to all of these charging stations being built and adding them and making it more efficient for people to charge their cars on the road with the fast chargers. But what does that do to the landscape? You mentioned some of them may be at current gas stations, so that doesn't seem to be as complicated. But there's talk about putting these in some perhaps more rural areas or areas that are currently not full of commercial entities, and they want to put in places for people to stop and eat and have facilities there because obviously they're going to be waiting a little while for the vehicle. Is there any concern of what this may do to the landscape?
It's a great question, Marianne. And a lot of city planners especially are excited at this prospect, as it is actually a way to think about what's the economic development and opportunity that can be created by designing and implementing charging hubs as a part of the cityscape. To the more rural areas at the Electrification Coalition, we have been looking more into that and working with partners. There's a lot of city centers, albeit small city centers, but really excited about how they can bring in charging as access and amenity. Think, for instance, about the Hocking Hills area, where that's a big tourism spot, a lot of hikers coming through, in a great way that nearby cities can put in charging and also stimulate the local economy by grabbing that cup of coffee or stopping off at a gift shop. So it does actually add some new element to it. Really, the way that we're hearing back from a lot of our city partners, they're thinking of it as a little bit of a downtown development opportunity and thinking about how it can fit into the city square or other key areas that they want to be sure folks are visiting.
All right. Well, yes, go ahead.
No, I just said, well said, Matt. That was brilliant.
All right. Well, thank you so much. We're going to continue our discussion about electric vehicles in just a moment with some myth busting. This is Cincinnati Edition. This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Marianne Zalesnik filling in for Lucy May. Now it's time to talk about some of the rumors about electric vehicles. Are they true or false? Joining me are staff writer at Wired Magazine, Ariane Marshall, director and senior fellow at the Center for Automotive Research at Ohio State University, Giorgio Rizzoni, and Electrification Coalition Director of Technical Services, Matt Stevens-Rich. We'd like to hear from you, too. You can call 513-419-7100 or email talk@wvxu.org. Now, one of the myths that we hear is that EVs are creating more air pollution. And are they?
If I may begin to address this, I teach this subject matter, actually, in a course I offer at Ohio State. And one of the first things we try to teach students who are trying to understand the future of energy in transportation systems is to explain that the primary energy source for the energy that we put in the vehicle needs to be assessed in all of its energy and environmental impacts. So the vast majority of vehicles today drive on the strength of a fuel that results from the refining of petroleum, that where we drill underground or under the sea, transport this petroleum, refine it, turn it into a fuel, and then burn this fuel in the engine of the automobile. That has inefficiencies associated with it, to the point that an average car probably only uses 25% of the energy that was contained in the original petroleum that we drilled for. Now let's go to electric vehicles. Electric vehicles offer significant advantages in that the electric machines that we use to convert the energy source into movement in the vehicle, they're much, much more efficient. They have efficiencies of the order of 90%. But we must not forget where the electricity originates. Electricity doesn't grow on trees, we have to make it. And so the question of how much carbon emissions are produced by the generation of electricity is an important one, and it's a complex one. I will not go into a lecture, I promise. But the idea is that we know there are websites that are third-party objective websites that'll tell you state by state, country by country. This information is available around the world. What is the carbon intensity of the electricity production? For example, in the U.S., region by region, here in Ohio, we are part of the PJM interconnection. Texas has its own interconnection. You move north and west of Ohio, and you have the Midwest interconnection system organization. So each of these regions supplies electric power that is made by burning coal, using nuclear power plants, using natural gas power plants, using hydroelectric power sources, using solar power and wind power. There are other smaller additional things, but these are the major ones. And so one can consider the mix of all of these things and say, okay, on average in Ohio, when I recharge my electric vehicle, I am essentially emitting so many grams of CO2 for every kilowatt hour of energy that I put into my battery pack. When you look at these averages, I can tell you that in the majority of the United States, these carbon emissions are considerably lower than those of a petroleum fuel car. So the answer to the question, are EVs less carbon emitting than a gasoline powered vehicle, is definitely yes. To what extent this is true now depends very much on what time one charges the vehicle, whether at that time the energy available is largely produced by non-carbon emitting power plants like wind, for example, or nuclear, or whether it's being produced by coal or natural gas. So the answer, you can say on average, we are better, but how much better is really determined by your location and the time of day. Now, it is also true that countries that make significant use of coal-powered electricity production, such as India and China, do not have a record of lowering carbon emissions with electric vehicles that is as favorable as North America or Europe, for example.
Let's talk about batteries, and Ariane, maybe you can address this. There's talk about some of the minerals that are being used to make these batteries. They're difficult to find, they're difficult to come by, and that is also making these not as friendly to the environment, perhaps. What do you know about that?
Yeah, so that's definitely true. And when we talk about the critical minerals that go into batteries, a lot of the conversation is not only about the kind of environmental effects of mining, which can be pretty significant and can have significant effects on the populations that live nearby where those things are mined, but also the kind of bigger geopolitical issues. There have been issues in the past with the cobalt mines in Africa, for example, using child labor. The folks who are participating in that industry not necessarily being paid fair wages. That's something, of course, that comes up in China as well. How is that labor being exploited? There are some solutions that are underway. Of course, there's what we were discussing earlier in the hour about the Biden administration trying to move some of those mining jobs to the U.S. Some of those critical minerals are available not only in the U.S., but in countries that we're allied with and that the government feels it can really kind of accurately track how fair their labor practices are. Also, something big and important that's happening that Giorgio alluded to earlier in the hour is there's so much work and money being spent on trying to figure out ways to get those critical minerals out of electric vehicle batteries. Can we build an electric vehicle battery with a chemistry that uses minerals that are cheaper and can be mined in more environmentally conscious ways and can be mined in different parts of the world? So I'd say it's like so many things we've been discussing this hour, very much a work in progress.
Let's talk about people's fears that it will collapse the power grid, that if everybody's charging their vehicles, there'll be such a drain on the power grid that it'll just shut down. Who knows the answer to that one?
Well, I'll kick us off, and I'm sure Giorgio can add more too. The good news is, and actually to Giorgio's earlier point about how energy efficient electric vehicles are, while it does create some local energy demand, especially to that last mile distribution along the wires, there are a lot of great ways to manage and spread out that charging load. So for instance, some utilities already employ different incentive models that point folks to charge overnight as a way to offset and move that charging load around throughout the day. That's a nice part to this where we can dispatch that charge load to happen at different points and times. It doesn't have to happen instantly, but instead we can orient it towards when do you need charging by, such as first thing in the morning. Ultimately, when we take all this load increase in consideration, while there is load that will be coming through EV charging, right now it looks to be about 1% new load growth year over year, which actually is behind other new loads, such as server centers and other AI generative technology. On the whole, utilities for the first time in decades are looking to add new load, which does create some new energy planning challenges and opportunity. But with EVs, it will be a part of the puzzle, but not as significant a portion of that base versus other things coming online too.
Giorgio?
Well said, Matt. Absolutely everything you said is correct. And so we're not on the verge of a precipice. Now, this is true certainly in Ohio and in the Midwest and in most of the US. I think California has a bit more of an issue with strain on their power grid. But there is another element that in the future could become important. Imagine a future in which you have a very large number of electric vehicles that plug in at different times of day and night. If the charging decisions can be controlled. That is, an intelligent operator at the power grid level knows when to stop charging a vehicle for 5 minutes, not one vehicle, but maybe 100 vehicles for 5 minutes to provide some demand response to another large energy request. All of these batteries that are in fact connected to the grid can serve a very useful balancing purpose. So in fact, going forward, this may provide some additional resilience and reliability to the electric power grid.
We are going to sneak in one question here before we run out of time. Patrick, what's your question?
Hi, I'm Patrick Sherwin with GoSun, a local inventor, and I've actually been working with solar and electric vehicles for 20 years. I recently reran the numbers and realized from the solar energy that falls on the rooftop of the vehicle, we can meet over 50% of the average driving needs. And we're, in fact, building a product to do that here in Cincinnati right now. And I just wanted to comment and let people know that GoSun is going to have a product available very soon so that you can actually literally drive on sunshine.
All right. Well, thank you, Patrick.
That's a wonderful thought, and it's been around for a while. The question is, how do you develop a commercial version of it that would be cost effective? And it sounds as if you're doing that. That's wonderful. But you said something that is very important. This is average power, right? You're continuously trickle charging the battery, taking advantage of essentially free energy. So in sunny climates, more useful than in rainy climates, but I think it's. I wish you all of your all of the success, and please get in touch with me if think we may be helpful.
We did get a call from someone who wants to know what happens to the spent batteries. Do they have to be recycled once they're used?
Yeah. Happy to chime in, and Ariane, you might have some additional thought to it too, I think, in some of your earlier reporting. There's a lot of, actually, to the collective point on just the material and minerals that go into those batteries, there is a lot of residual value in those batteries. And even before we get to recycling, often batteries for electric vehicle purposes, they'll see a useful life just to about the 80 to 70% state of charge left on the battery, which is, there's still useful life there. They can see a really successful second use. So utilities more and more are starting to deploy used EV batteries as anything from voltage regulation to other different elements of control on the grid, which is really exciting second use case for it.
We are out of time. I hate to do it to you. There's so much more. I'm sure we'll all have you back again because there's so much more to talk about this and so many questions. Thank you all for being here today. I appreciate it.
Thank you. A pleasure to be
Thank
here.
Thank you.
I've been talking with staff writer at Wired Magazine, Ariane Marshall, director and senior fellow at the Center for Automotive Research at Ohio State University, Giorgio Rizzoni, and Electrification Coalition director of technical services, Matt Stevens-Rich. Producer of Cincinnati Edition is Selena Reeder. Associate producer is Asiya Johnson. Technical director is Marshall Verbsky. I'm Ariane Zalesnik, filling in for Lucy May. Thanks for listening.